Hi, this is David. Before we get into today's podcast, I want to tie up a little loose end from our previous podcast where we reviewed Izzy Skinner's animation of The Wheel in Space. Izzy got in touch with us to let us know that the animation took only 2 years for her and her partner Steve to put together rather than the 15 years that we had said. So we stand corrected, and thank you again to Izzy for making this fantastic animation available to all of Doctor Who fandom. And now on to today's podcast.
Welcome everyone to episode 260 of the Metabolus 2 podcast featuring myself, Ben.
And I am David, and Happy New Year's. It's our first 2024 podcast, or 2025.
I think you'll find it's 2025.
Oh my gosh, yes.
We're in the space year 2025, yeah.
Yeah, I'm still getting used to 2024. And
yeah, only 500 years, and then we'll find out whether man is still alive.
Oh.
Just a mere 500 years to go.
We'll just hang out until then.
Exactly.
We'll try to get at least another 260 podcast in between.
Between
now
here and 2025. And what are we talking about in this New Year's podcast, David?
Well, we're catching up with all the Doctor Who holiday treats.
Oh,
and
treats,
the Christmas special, I think, is due up with RTD Stephen Moffat joint of Joy to the World.
Joy to the World. Yeah, it's Stephen Moffat having said he would never come back to write a Who story. He's back to write a Who story again, having said he'd never write a Who story again. So yeah, he's like Al Pacino in Godfather 3.
Keep dragging him back.
Keep dragging him back, yeah. I didn't watch this live, unfortunately, because I was deep in Christmas with my family, and it seems to kind of, you know, put a damper on the day. Like, sorry, shut up, everyone be quiet. Watching Doctor Who, it might not be good. But, you know, of course, with the miracle of shifted viewing or whatever people call it nowadays, I was able to watch it later on the iPlayer. So in the comfort of just myself and my nephew Finn. So that was very nice.
Yeah.
You were able to find it over the airways over the Christmas period?
Yeah. Okay, good. Santa Claus delivered it to me in the manner that Santa Claus always delivers Doctor Who to me. So
exactly. His big sack.
Yep. Big sack of
Doctor Who stuff.
Material. Yeah. Yes,
Nick Frost. Yes, okay.
So yeah, I was able to watch it. I think I watched it sometime in early January.
Yeah.
Never quite got around to it during the Christmas season.
Not
even sure I saw it within the 12 days of Christmas, to be honest with you.
Well, that's important, because if you don't see it within the 12 days of Christmas, then you'll have 7 years bad luck.
Yeah.
Exactly how it goes. I still don't like the color scheme. Everything's too pastel. That's just a really facile comment to make to kick off, but I really would like some darkness. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, them shooting on this huge Mandalorian style, you know, light stage, which gives them kind of, you know, vistas and stuff. I just think it makes everything too bright, everything too pastel. That's just me. I did also think that it was kind of typical Moffat. Like, it's a crack. It's some statues. It's that stuff you find in your eyes in the morning. Mm-hmm. Like a thing that only he has ever noticed becomes something interesting and Doctor Who-ish. And in this case, of course, it's the locked door in the hotel
room
that you're
staying
in, which usually is just the door to the next door room in case there's more than one of you.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you have children and the children sleep in one room and you sleep in the other. So it's not actually a huge mystery why there's a locked door in a lot of hotel rooms. But, you know, I guess it could be a kind of Narnia style portal to something else. Those are my two kind of initial thoughts going into the whole thing. I thought it was fine. I wasn't blown away with it. I mean, it had more. It kind of flowed better than some of the other stories in the first season, I thought. And it wasn't quite so frantic and the story was relatively simple for Stephen Moffat.
Mm-hmm.
There was like a bootstrap thing, which of course he likes. And then there was a like, the person is dead, but actually it's great. Which again, that's another thing I didn't really like about it. Like the, you know, like the landmine episode where like your father's dead, but and he's a robot and that's great. Like the woman's dead and she's been turned into the Star of Bethlehem. That's amazing. Which actually, no, she's dead and she's been blown up and turned into a star. That's kind of horrible. But anyway, that's just me. So those were sort of initial thoughts about it, I think. As I said, it was okay. I enjoyed it more than the series of Chibnall holiday episodes, if that's saying something, which probably isn't because I didn't enjoy those at all.
Well, I thought it was a story of two parts, really. We had the story revolving around Joy and the Time Hotel, and then we had the story of Anita. And of the two stories, I thought Anita got more airtime and actually had a more interesting story with the Doctor.
It was almost as if I wanted to happen is for Anita to take over the story in some way. Actually to become Anita's story, for Anita to become the companion for an episode, the main person that the Doctor is relating to. And I thought it was a shame that didn't happen.
I thought pretty much she was, other than that this is her first, the actress is Stephanie Diwali, and this is her first television credit, opposed to really? Nicola Coughlan, which is, she's the Bridgerton.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bridgerton. And so Steph did way better or had more screen time. I thought just had more emotion to her other than, oh, I'm a star. Although the stuff that Nicola had to do, which was a total comment about the COVID lockdown and then the Tories breaking all the rules, I thought was really good. And I mean, that's a credit to Moffat's writing. And I think that's probably how he got into that was what he wanted to tell in the story. And all the other stuff is Doctor Who dressing. He wanted to make that comment saying, look, people's loved ones died alone while the rich and powerful broke the rules and partied
right.
And I think that was his idea. And then how can I make a Doctor Who story on it? Like you said, it's a little bit of Voyage of the Damned ending with Joy becoming the Star of Bethlehem. I thought that was a little cheap, I guess. I don't know. Crass. It just didn't work for me at all.
I mean, yeah, I mean, do you think that's obviously this is a Christmas special.
Yeah.
And if you saw it as like a, you know, as a it's not a nativity play, but you know, I'm certainly in Britain, like the whole kind of Christmas story is kind of like a big Christmas thing, in a way that the Christmas story really isn't a Christmas thing in the United States, because, you know, secular country, Santa Claus, here are some presents. It's Tom Hanks and Buddy the Elf. So, yeah, I actually thought that fitted quite well for me, because it felt like a part of a nativity play, like the kind of play you do at school when you're like a little child, and everyone does those. And it made it feel kind of, you know, a little Star of Bethlehem, blah, blah, blah. It made it feel kind of childish, but in a good way. Mm. I kind of liked that, actually. That's one bit I liked.
The two storylines, one with Anita and the one with Joy, I thought meshed pretty well with the conclusion of Anita's arc was never be alone at Christmas, was what she was telling the Doctor as they departed. And that meshes with Joy's mom dying alone in the hospital, never be alone at Christmas.
Right.
So writerly, I think Moffat worked pretty well. It just, you know, it had a lot of the Moffat type tropes. Like you said, the bootstrap paradox is sort of like, I don't like that. That doesn't make, it never makes sense to me. It's sort of like, oh yeah, I just remember myself telling me that previously. And it's sort of like, no, I don't like those kind of dumb explanations.
It was so bootstrappy that I actually had to pause it and like rewind and like, hang on, what was that? It was the most bootstrap paradox that he's ever done. In fact, it was so bootstrappy that I didn't really understand what was happening.
The loop is, I heard myself tell me that when I came in from the future, and I just remembered it and told myself again when I, you know, it's a loop, and it's a dumb loop.
It is a dumb loop. Yeah. It's not clever.
Well, it's Moffat, yep. and the Moffat fans think that is clever, and I just think it's sloppy, personally. I mean, okay.
You know what? I'm going to tell him that when I meet him at Gallifrey.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll care.
I'm sure, A, he'll listen, and B, he'll care.
So just the whole concept of the Time Hotel, it just stretches credulity. It's sort of, okay, by 2400, humans develop time travel of some sort, and they aren't worried about anything like the butterfly paradox, where you step on the butterfly and
right,
and it just again buggers belief. I guess it just doesn't seem like the aspects of plausibility weren't there.
Did we need the Time Hotel for the plot to work properly? I'm not really sure we did that much. It seemed like it's a fun concept. It's a fun Christmassy concept. It's a fun concept, but that's kind of all it is. It doesn't really, as kind of you just pointed, well, I mean, most things in Doctor Who don't make a huge amount of sense, but even within the kind of nonsensibleness of Doctor Who in general, the Time Hotel seemed more like a fun thing to have happen. It was more like a Douglas Adams thing, which doesn't have to fit into any kind of sensible understanding of how the universe might function. It's just a fun, amusing thing to occur. And that's kind of the way they treated it. You know, you got the Orient Express, you got like the Tenzing, you got Sherpa Tenzing and Edmund Hillary, probably. You've got like a Tyrannosaurus.
Which is becoming a Moffat trademark.
And a bunch of other stuff.
Just throwing a Tyrannosaurus.
Oh, yeah. Well, at least it was a normal size this time rather than the ridiculously huge Tyrannosaurus it was.
That
episode was.
I don't know. Yeah. I'm not sure you actually needed that to work at all, but it was kind of Christmas fluff filler.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying. And even though, you know, Christmas episodes do have silly, fluffy things like a spaceship mm-hmm. that's like shaped like the Titanic, you know, or like flying sharks. Those fluff things, you can make them fit. But I mean, a literal time hotel that is going to happen in less than 500 years from now. Yeah. And as you point out, you know, if humans had invented time travel to that extent that they can do a hotel, it's like, well, all bets are off then. I mean, like, we're basically time lords at that point.
Also, I thought go to your favorite assassination bit was again a bit tacky. It just tonally, some of these things were tonally off, and so you know that there, if you're putting the Star of Bethlehem in there, you know there's a portal to the crucifixion too. So it just isn't the fun kind of Christmas thing I'm looking for, and it's not because it's plays footsie with Christianity, which is for Christmas type thing. It just seems like a grab bag of Moffatisms that isn't well thought of, and if you put it into any kind of thought on how does this actually exist, it all just kind of, well, it would destroy everything. It just breaks down.
Yeah,
and that's I don't like that in Moffat's type writing.
And I think you know, obviously on many occasions we've said that, you know, one of the great things about Doctor Who, doesn't really have any continuity, which is awesome, and we like that. However, mm-hmm. it does have rules. And, you know, the rules around time travel obviously have evolved organically as the show has developed, but it's pretty restricted. It pops up from time to time when it's needed. And, you know, Sontarans have time travel, which was established from the very beginning of that particular race of monsters, which I think we've sort of struggled with going forward. Obviously, the Daleks have developed time travel.
Yeah.
There's a time war, which we now know about. Time travel for kind of frivolous holiday fun, that's kind of frowned on in the Doctor Who universe, and I think would get sat on pretty quickly by the powers that be in terms of organizing stuff. So I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I don't think it was necessary for the plot. I'd have to think more about the plot, which I probably should have done to work out whether I believe that or not. But I think you could have done it without a time travel hotel. I think you had the time hotel in order to, as I said, make it all Douglas Adamsy and kind of fun feeling. Mm-hmm. But I mean, time travel is not, it really has not ever been, it doesn't really get played for fun that much in the Doctor Who universe.
No.
The Whoniverse, as obviously we like to call it.
The only person that has fun with time travel would be the Doctor.
And the monk, maybe. Meddling monk.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway.
So the basic plot was Villengard, the weapons company, created this seed, star seed or whatever, that had to mature over 65 billion years or something like that. And so they have this briefcase that kills people as they upgrade into more security access to get into the room that was back 65 million years ago, which was the dinosaur. That's basically the reason for the time hotel, or the reason the...
Right.
Which is all, you know, artificial kind of MacGuffin anyways, because there's no reason it has to take 65 billion years for this to grow up and generator anyways. And
true.
So again, I think the seed, the kernel of this was the don't be alone at Christmas, and that's the two storylines between Anita and Joy, with Joy being feeling the guilt
right
over being alone, or having your mom die alone on Christmas, and then Anita basically living a solitary life as a hotel concierge, I guess. I'm not sure, aside from her now working for the Time Hotel, you know, she had that brief year hanging out with the Doctor, but beyond that, it seemed like she went back to, you know, her solitary existence. And although she tells the Doctor don't be alone on Christmas, she is also going to be alone on Christmas.
Right, right. Halfway through the kind of Anita section of the story, which is sort of three quarters of the way through the story, you know, when it kind of slowed down to that, the Doctor spending a year hanging around in one of those kind of cheap hotels in central London where tourists go to.
Mm-hmm.
I was really hoping that the story was going to really flip and be something less pastel colored and less frivolous.
It is Christmas after all. It is. It's going to be a throwaway story.
Yeah, but then it didn't. And I thought the whole kind of Indiana Jones, yet again, we're in some kind of temple where someone's lit all the candles, don't know who.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you know, you attach the rope to the train, and that's all. That's kind of Looney Tunes stuff, which I guess we've established with the big hammer.
Mallet.
We've established that there is a Looney Tunes element now to the universe, which I guess is fine. I'm not very happy with it.
Tying the rope to pull out the block through the train. Yeah, it's sort of like,
I mean, I guess, you know, you could go all the way back to the Daleks and the, you know, moving the Earth around the universe, and then the TARDIS, like, tugging all the planets back to where they had come from originally back in the 2000s. But still, it's like, recently we've had, you know, dragging Sutek by his lead through the time vortex. We've had quite a lot of that. And it's like, I guess what I'm saying is I find the kind of physical solutions to what must be in some ways metaphysical problems difficult to get my head around, to be honest. I don't know how that would work, but then I don't know how a time hotel would work, to be honest. So maybe pull a rope from a room, attach it to the back of a train, and you know, then it pulls a piece of stone through several times and spaces. Which again makes this time hotel so radically useful that, you know, why are people using it to have a fun time at Christmas? I mean, what an amazing tool this time hotel would be. What a crazy weapon that Daleks or Cybermen would be, you know, falling over themselves to take over a time hotel, or Silurians even would be falling over themselves. So yeah, any villain would want to run a time hotel.
Time is not static at that point. The past is going to be always going to be changing.
Right.
It's no longer a thing of the past, because there's always going to be someone there's going to go back and try to change it to their advantage.
Yeah, yeah. Which again makes the whole Time Hotel thing something that just doesn't fit within the Doctor Who universe. Mm-hmm. And I think it's only there as a piece of Christmas fluff. It's going to have no something as massively universe changing as the concept of a time hotel is not going to have any effect on any story going forward. The Doctor is never going to go back to the Time Hotel, even though it might be super useful to do so to solve a particular plot that's, you know, running into difficulties. We're never going to see the Time Hotel again, even though it's a complete game changer in terms of how this universe functions.
I don't know. It's conceivable that we'll see it.
It seems so useful that, you know, I don't know. It would solve a lot of problems.
I can see it being the cause of, well, this is actually a problem and we need to actually shut down the Time Hotel type plot.
We need to shut down the Time Hotel. Yeah, I think, yeah.
But you wouldn't do that because now you have Anita working there. So, yeah, I don't know.
You have to give her another job or something. Maybe you could make her a Time Lord or something. Like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I think it was the really good example of an inconsequential Christmas episode where everything is like fun and silly, apart from the whole Moffat death is not the end thing, mm-hmm. Where, you know, we're kind of sad that someone is going to blow up and turn into a star, but actually we're happy because they've just blown up and turned into a star.
Yeah, it reminded me of how Bill isn't dead.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think of that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It reminded me of how in The Voyage of Dam, how Kylie didn't really die or was a star.
Right, right.
And kind of a combination of those two endings, one being an RTD ending, one being a Moffat ending. So
Yeah. Which kind of, you know, again, certainly with Bill, kind of like that's kind of sucks all the horror out of her passing and makes it something happy, which is, I guess, is fine. I don't know. Anyway, yeah.
So by saying this as a, you know, kind of a Christmas throwaway episode, it will only have consequence in 40 years' time when, a la Brain of Morbius, somebody decides to take a whole monkey wrench the entire franchise and use this as a basis to reset or redo everything. That's the difficulty or the time bomb that you set with these kind of frivolous throwaway.
Yeah.
There's only 13 regenerations. Who's ever going to lock on to that and not let that go. Or the Doctor possibly had pre-regenerations before the Hartnell Doctor, etc. So once introduced, it becomes part of the landscape of Doctor Who, and it will materialize in strange ways in the future.
You know what I would have done if I was Stephen Moffat, and I've just thought of this? I'd have tied the whole Time Hotel in with the War Games and had like the hotel master and the hotel chief. with like big thick glasses on, and that's what it was. That's what I'd have done. And then you see the cut down War Games, which I'm sure we will be discussing at some point in our podcast Odyssey. It would have like segued directly into the Christmas special.
I like that actually. Yeah, because but then, you know, it also explains why it was bad, because
right,
and you needed the Time Lords to undo it,
right?
But Chibnall's gotten rid of all the Time Lords, so
exactly. So the whatever species the kind of warlords are,
right,
they're now hotel lords,
hoteliers,
yeah, if you will. Because there's no Time Lords anymore, or currently in the Doctor universe, there's no Time Lords.
There are no, and that's whole explains whole reason why you can have a Time Hotel, because
exactly,
there's no one minding the shop.
Exactly, there's no one minding the shop. It's all going to shit. It's all chaotic. Okay, as usual, you and I, through a process of Socratic debate, have solved all of the problems of this episode. Like very, very quickly. And if only they just call us, we'd get it done. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I would have done. But, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not in charge of Doctor Who, so it's never going to happen.
I think if a future showrunner, a future writer can say, okay, the reason why a time hotel exists is because there are no Nora Time Lords.
Exactly.
This is, again, causing problems.
Yeah.
And so how do we shut this thing down?
And so there'll be, you know, some future Time Lords who'll be kind of discovered hiding in another dimension or whatever will come in, and a bunch of Chancery guards will come in and shoot everybody and set the hotel on fire. And jobs are good. No more time hotel.
Just block up all the doors.
Block up all the doors with bricks.
Mm-hmm.
Time bricks.
Time bricks.
The bricks of Rassilon, if you will. Of which there are enough to block up a bunch of doors.
There you go.
Apparently. Yeah, there you go. So that's... What do you think of everyone's performances?
Aside from Anita Ben, or the Steph DeWally character, I thought... Joel Fry's portrayal of Trev Simpkins, Trev, was the other one that was a standout for me. So I liked Trev and Anita. Other than that, I thought Shooty was okay.
Yeah, it was less weepy than he's been in previous episodes, so I liked that.
There was a little bit of tears, I thought, at the end.
Yeah, it was the end, though. He wasn't weeping during it. I mean, I'm fine if he weeps at the end. That's fine, but yeah, it's like, yeah. But anyway, yeah. Carrie, I was interrupting. Yes, Shooty.
I thought he was okay. It just doesn't feel like Doctor Who to me, like with these kind of stories that the Doctor's really not doing anything other than the main Doctory thing was to bootstrap and
right.
Beyond that, because Joy was, I guess, imprinted with the star seed, and that was...
It was always going to happen, yeah.
Right, and...
Yeah, not a huge amount for the Doctor to do, which is, a shame in some ways.
I mean, it was nice to see Hilary and Norgay, I guess. I would have liked to have a whole story with them.
Yeah.
If we're going to do a celebrity historical, that would have been interesting.
Yeah, get some Yetis in the mix. Get the snowman, Yeti, great intelligence stuff back again. I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, the character Sylvia Trench, I mean, that's a James Bond character. So I don't know if that was supposed to be deliberate, that she was on the Orient Express.
Well, here we if you go to the Wikipedia page for Joy to the World, you'll find that that's exactly what Stephen Moffat wanted her to be, is to be the same Sylvia Trench that James Bond is involved in Doctor No and From Russia with Love.
Okay. Well, there you go.
So, yeah, same woman, apparently.
So
here you go. Neve Marie Smith played Sylvia Trench, a passenger on the Orient Express, blah, 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 who Moffat confirmed as the same character as the love interest of James Bond in the films Dr. No and From Russia with Love.
Yeah, well, there you go. I just recognized the name Sylvia Trench, and I go, that was a Bond character.
And indeed it was, so yeah.
Let's see, the Silurian hotel manager. I'm not into those Silurians at all, so...
Well, true. I mean, the thing is, you couldn't have like an old school Silurian be a hotel manager. You're like, no,
I am the manager now.
Where's my flugelhorn? though, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess we're getting the whole war between the land and the sea thing is barreling down the pike at us at terrific speed. So
you think they'll have Silurians in there and not just sea devils?
I mean, excuse my French. Knows. I don't know. What's going to go on with that one, really. Just as a sidebar, my big hope for the war between the land and the sea is fish people.
You think from underwater menace?
Yep, we need fish people. We need their big, unconvincing eyes and their flappy, silvery wings, and we need them doing stuff. And if we don't have fish people in that, I'm going to riot.
Well... It'll be a riot of one, but...
Yeah, there you go.
a quiet riot.
Who knows? Who knows whether we're going to have Silurians? I think so. I think we'll have Silurians in it. We had Silurians in Warriors from the Deep, and that was all under the water and stuff.
I suppose.
Anyway, so maybe we're just kind of reintroducing the concept of the Silurian, but the kind of urbane hotel manager-style Silurian that we're now... stuck with.
Well, he's dead.
I also don't care for them. Well, no, but I mean, in general, the Silurians seem to be kind of, you know, more urbane and well behaved than they were in kind of. I'm just thinking, what's his name? Who's the Who was this Ted Silurian in the Moffat Silurian episodes? It was
Stephen
in
Moore?
Hitchhikers.
Is that right?
Yeah, it is Stephen Moore. Yeah, Stephen Moore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Rather than the Flugelhorn, you know, monsters from the dawn of time, like these kind of Lovecraftian, you know, nightmares, which is what Silurians were originally and what they should still be. But that's an argument for another day.
That just reminds me of, you know, you mentioned Doctor Crying at the end. With the restored Season 7 Blu-ray that's coming out for the Doctor Who and the Silurians, they were able to enhance the video enough at the end when the Brigadier is blowing up the caves that the Doctor actually has teary eyes at the end. So the great man himself, John Pertwee, as the Doctor, as the Silurians were being entombed in their own caves, he had the teary eyes.
I did not know that. That's another reason to... I pretty much made the decision I'm going to have to start buying the Blu-rays. So once my kind of... once I've got a spare moment, all my DVDs are being sold and I'm going to go straight to Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, which I should have done years ago. Should have listened to you, but, you know, there you go.
Well, I was on the fence and I...
I mean, season six, I mean, yeah, that's such a fabulous season. I would just like to see that on Blu-ray, basically. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so yeah, so that's just another sidebar from George of the World.
Yeah, they've improved the color restoration significantly on the Silurians.
Wow.
Yeah. So looking forward to that when that drops eventually.
Absolutely. Yeah. Of course. And also an enhanced level of Flugelhorn on the soundtrack is what we're after.
Indeed.
So back to George of the World. Yeah, it was okay, which is, you know, damning with faint praise, really. It was all right. It felt jolly enough to be Christmassy. It didn't feel spooky, which, you know, is, I think you've got to have some element of spookiness at Christmas time. Certainly, I think you should. Anyway, it felt silly and the stakes were, as usual, relatively low. It's nice to have a shout out to people who died because of COVID while Boris Johnson was having a party.
Yeah.
Whether that really fit with the whole tone of the thing, I don't know.
I think that was his, I still think that was his story seed. And because
really?
That's how the two,
right, okay,
yeah, I really think that's everything else is dressing around that message that I think that he wanted to deliver.
Right. Don't be alone at Christmas. Yeah.
Because he wasn't showrunner during COVID, and this is like his opportunity to get that out.
Yeah. It does hit quite hard, that, because I think everybody knows, well, I know, people who died on their own in hospital during COVID. And, I was very conscious of this watching it with my nephew, whose other grandmother died in similar circumstances. And it's like, should an episode that's quite so frothy and fluffy and Looney Tunesy be leaning into something that's really quite recent and actually quite real for a good proportion of the population?
I think Moffat has, as a writer and as a person, has struggles with mortality. And I think he flubs it again a little bit with death, like he did with Dark Water,
right,
and don't do cremations,
right.
I just don't feel this is a area that Doctor Who needs to dwell on, and maybe it's a concern more of Moffat than of the show itself, or it could be just that the problems that the world face are not problems anymore that the Doctor can solve. And RTD has made the show so the Doctor's fighting these bigger alien invasions and all this other stuff, but really we're facing things like climate change and the rise of authoritarianism, and these are types of things that the Doctor should be able to fix if they're on other planets, but since they're Earth, he can't.
Can't be done.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, yeah, again, as we've said before, why, you know, the Doctor never goes back to Nazi Germany or, you know, I don't know, Cambodia under Pol Pot or whatever and fixes that. Because that's real stuff that can't be fixed. And, I don't know, if I was an old person dying of COVID at Christmas time and I looked out the window and saw a star, maybe I'd feel better about it. I don't know. I guess hopefully I'll never know whether that would be something that would make me feel better or not. I doubt it, but maybe. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, yes, this all felt very Moffat-y.
Well, I don't I'm not sure that Joy's mom felt better. I think it was implied that she, like all the other people ahead of her that were dissolved by the briefcase, actually became part of the star at the end.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they had kind of that particle effect go on and then kind of her sweep out the window.
Okay. I guess I watched it less recently than you have. I just kind of remember her looking out the window and seeing the star and like, oh, that's my daughter up there. So knowing that's, and then being comforted by that. But okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was that Joy was reclaiming her mom or taking her mom's life essence up into the Star of Bethlehem.
Right. Yeah.
Again.
Yeah, also makes sense the way you put it. Yeah, okay. Mm.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe.
So.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have much more to say on this other than.
No, neither do I. As I said, it was fine. It was fine. Yeah.
Do you like this one better than the Singing Goblins of the Church on Ruby Road?
Yes, I liked it better than the Goblins, yes.
Okay.
I mean, the whole Goblin thing, I don't know, yeah. It just felt too Harry Potter to me, and I hate Harry Potter, so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, don't hate Harry Potter, the person, if he's not actually a real person. I don't like the whole Harry Potter universe.
Yeah.
And Goblins just feel like that's a sop to that kind of desire to have Goblins.
But we'd had the tie-in or the connection back to Ruby Sunday with Millie Gibson's cameo at the end with her mobile.
Right.
And I'm not... Was it implying that she was trying to call the doctor then? I'm not really sure what we were supposed to take away with that.
There's the whole RTD has, you know, Easter eggs that, like, pay off in completely unfounded ways by the end, and then Moffat has Easter eggs which don't pay off at all because he kind of forgets about them and doesn't really know how to fix them and therefore doesn't do anything about them. It's one of those two things.
My guess is Millie Gibson's returning sometime in this following season.
Yeah, and the whole, like, she's leaving thing was like a fake out. Well, I mean, we got to find out who, you know, who Nita Dobson is, haven't we, really? Mrs. Flood, if that's a thing.
Yeah, I think they've leaked who she is.
Oh, who is she?
Well, spoilers for anyone who might be listening.
Plug your ears, anyone who's listening. Tell me. I mean, I'm genuinely interested.
What I have heard is she's one of the Guardians. Either the white or dark. Or there's no... they're no longer white or black Guardians. It's like the light or
either
dark
white
Guardian
chocolate or dark
something.
Chocolate. Right. Yeah. Interesting. Okay, well, that would make sense. Yeah. Because, well, I mean, she...
Don't know if that's for sure, but I think it was in a BBC press release that they then redacted.
Okay, yeah. Because she was very present. So the other thing I watched, well, obviously I watched a lot of telly when I was in the UK. But anyway, when I was back home, I watched Doctor Who at the Proms, which was quite fun actually. But she was very, very in that. So they're obviously, she's not being forgotten about. She's definitely a thing. And to have her be, yeah, because we've already, because there's merch with Guardians on it now. So obviously Guardians are back.
Doctor Who merch?
Yeah, Doctor Who merch, yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Because I went to Forbidden Planet to pick up some Millie Gibson and Shooty Gatwa action figures, as you do.
Yep.
And there was a bunch of merch there, and some of the merch had Guardians on it. It's like, okay, well, that's...
Interesting.
They wouldn't do that, because, I mean, it's a deep cut. Let's face it, for the modern audience, they wouldn't do that if the Guardians weren't coming back full time. And I guess I'm just, you know, what I was going to say is we already know that Guardians are coming back full time because we've already had the slightly unrequired, if that's a word, not required Guardian of Music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you like the Mr. Ben cameo advertising in there? Did you catch that?
No. I missed that. What was that?
In the Time Hotel lobby, there was...
You're full of good stuff.
There was a Mr. Ben clothier or haberdashery shop for the time traveler. So Mr. Ben outfits of all times and ages.
Oh, wow. It was called Mr. Ben's?
And Mr. B-E-N-N.
Oh, wow. Did the guy have like a fez?
I think he had a knight helmet.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, because the guy who runs the magic costume shop in Mr. Ben has a fez and a mustache.
Yeah, it was in the first few minutes in the Time Hotel.
I missed that. I will have to go back and watch it. I loved Mr. Ben when I was a kid. I absolutely loved that show.
Very good. Very good. That is, well, that is everything I have to say on Joy to the World. Do you have anything else?
I'm done. Well. Yeah, that's all I have to say, really. It was okay.
Damned with faint praise. It was okay.
Okay.
All right.
It was fine. At least it wasn't egregiously irritating like some of the Chibnall's.
No, it didn't make me go grrr.
Yeah, it didn't make me go grrr like some of the Chibnall ones did. So, yeah, hats off to RTD and Stephen for not making me grind my teeth.
Well, thank you for listening to episode 260 of the Metabulous 2 podcast. I have been searching for the Time Hotel door to 2025 with Ben.
And I am excited by the prospect of reacquainting myself with Mr. Ben, who's my namesake, with David.
Until next time.
Farewell.
Ya me mimo el topo del cielo, ella enciende una vela y nuestra del camino. Soy vos el corredor y yo te dije diciendo: Welcome to the Hotel California, such a lovely place, such a lovely place. Welcome to the Hotel California, such a lovely place, such a lovely place. Such a lovely place.